This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
The latest looming nuclear catastrophe from Fukushima, Japan, the truth about the tar sands, and global warming comedy from Lee Camp, coming up next on Radio EcoShock. The nuclear accident at Fukushima, Japan is far from over. Three reactors continue to melt down, and now there's a storm of international worry about nuclear fuel ponds tottering in blown-up buildings. The whole northern hemisphere is at risk right now. I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock. We are joined again by nuclear industry expert Arnold Gunderson of Fairwinds Associates. Arnie Gunderson, a year ago you warned us right here on Radio EcoShock and to anybody else who would listen that a world-scale catastrophe was lurking in the nuclear fuel storage ponds of both reactors 3 and 4 at the Fukushima Daiichi plant in Japan. Why do you think this story is finally getting wider attention now, a year later?
Well, I think, you know, the drama of seeing units explode and the talk of meltdown has finally subsided, and that allows what little press there is that's covering it to move on to what's in fact the much bigger story, and that's the condition of the fuel in Unit 4's fuel pool. And I'm glad you mentioned it in the lead in there, that Unit 3's fuel pool should also be a concern to policymakers. This Mark I design is so fragile, and everybody was focused on what's inside the containment. But we're at a point now where we really have to worry about what's outside the containment.
Yeah, well, let me just read a couple things into the record here. The Japanese press, which has been following the government line up till now, is starting to break out. On April 2nd, Takao Yamada, expert senior writer for Mainichi paper, said, quote, "The seven-story building itself has suffered great damage, and with the storage pool barely intact on the building's third and fourth floors, the roof has been blown away. If the storage pool breaks and runs dry, the nuclear fuel inside will overheat and explode, causing a massive amount of radioactive substances to be spread over a wide area." And we also had the unusual case of Japan's former ambassador to Switzerland, Matsui Murata, speaking out at a public hearing of the Budgetary Committee on March 22, 2012, and he told the Swiss if Reactor 4 fuel pool collapses, the cooling water for all six reactors could be shut down, as well as for a nearby spent fuel pool with another 6,000 rods. And then finally, Arnie, we have Japanese diplomat Akio Matsumura. He's blogging about this publicly. It's very surprising Japanese officials are speaking out. Why now? Do they know something we don't?
Well, I've been working with Akio Matsumura now for more than a year on this problem. And I have to give him a lot of credit. He has been persistent and single-focused on the issue of these fuel pools. But Gordon Edwards in Canada and I have been talking to Ambassador Matsumura frequently on the fuel pool issue. I'd like to think that the book we wrote has a little impact on this as well. They call it the kimono band. The colored band around the book, in Japanese only, says, the quote that they lifted from the book is that if Unit 4 collapses, you're going to have to evacuate Tokyo. But that's not news. It's a new book. But I think, you know, the combination of Ambassador Matsumura's work for a long time now, basically a year, the book out there, and also, you know, what amazes me is the frequency of earthquakes in Japan. It has been dramatically higher, actually leading up to the big 9.0. For about 3 or 4 months before that, there was a dramatic increase in the 4s and the 5s and the 6s in Japan. Something has shifted in the plates off of the coast of Japan. You know, I have friends in Tokyo, and they're saying there's noticeably more significant tremblers in Tokyo than there were back in 2010. That combination is forcing people to realize that Fukushima is not going to go away anywhere anytime soon.
Well, now, what is the book? Tell us about that.
It's published by Shueisha. It's available in Japanese only on Amazon.jp. Maggie and I were interviewed by a woman journalist who then took that long interview, 5-6 days of interview, and put them in a book back in October, which then got published in February, and I was in Japan speaking to the Japanese press club. But it's entitled Fukushima Daiichi, The Truth and the Way Forward. I think it's important that the Japanese understand that there are alternatives to nuclear going forward that Tokyo Electric really doesn't want them to understand.
And you raised this thing about more earthquakes, and I found some research in a paper. It's in a journal called Solid Earth. It's a journal of the European Geosciences Union, and it's by Dapeng Zhao, who is a geophysics professor at Japan's Tohoku University. And he says that the giant earthquake of March 2011 has reactivated a seismic fault closer to the Fukushima nuclear plant. And using the latest scientific techniques and measurements, this paper warns another big quake could strike even closer to the plant. And one blog, Washington's blog, which is a pretty good blog, it says, scientists say there is a 70% chance of a magnitude 7 earthquake hitting Fukushima this year and a 98% chance within the next 3 years. And you said in an interview with Dr. Helen Caldicott back in February that if they got another 7 quake, that could do it. That could bring the reactor 4 fuel pool down.
Yeah, I think we give ourselves as a species more credit than we deserve, because we look back and at the historical record, but really, you know, we've only been analyzing this for 100 years and trying to go back in the historical record perhaps 1,000. But you're stuck with the situation of a high consequence event that you believed has been low probability. But, you know, now we've got these papers saying that we've got the significant likelihood of serious earthquakes, and they're not low probability. So we've got the worst confluence. You know, you've got the high probability event combined with the high seriousness. And that's certainly a frightening place to be. And that's where Japan is right now.
Well, it seems to me, and many Radio EcoShock listeners from all over the world have written me about this, that we're sleepwalking through a potential global catastrophe, and they want to know, why isn't there an international emergency action plan to save us from this? It's something that might make Chernobyl look small in comparison. Have you heard rumblings about that? What are your thoughts?
I have no information about any kind of a global concerted effort. You know, I know the Nuclear Regulatory Commission provides information. But the way the world community is structured on nuclear reactors, there is no organization that pulls together a coordinated response. It might be a little different on nuclear bombs, but the nuclear reactors are very much seen as everybody's own domestic policy. You know, whether that's a developing country in the third world or a massive industrial country like Japan, it's basically been hands-off. Each country has the right to monitor and improve or disassemble their own reactors. I don't understand that because, as you just said, we are looking at the possibility of a global calamity. But the way the international law is structured, and also, frankly, trying to get the interest of the State Department and the President, is an incredibly difficult process. You know, they bounce along to the worst problem right now as opposed to, you know, really recognizing that there's a serious one just over the horizon.
Well, we have social protests and actions on all sorts of things, even 9/11 and all sorts of things like that. But I'm not willing to just sit here and wait and see whether myself and my grandchild are irradiated, to see whether the Japanese do something. I'm just not willing to wait for that.
I agree with you, and you know, I've been talking to as many government officials as I can, but I really haven't sensed that they have a fire lid on under them on this. I guess that's a bad analogy when we're talking about fuel pool fires, but I really don't sense that they have any burning desire to tackle the problem. You know, there's three ways you can tackle this problem. The first way is to gamble that the existing trolley is strong enough to put the spent fuel cask into the Unit 4 pool as it is. It seems like I think Japanese officials are considering that as an alternative. The problem is that that particular trolley is weakened by the explosions and the fire, and if you were to try it, it may fail, in which case it would puncture the floor of the spent fuel pool. The last thing in the world you want is, as you're moving fuel, is to drop a spent fuel canister through that floor, because it will crack the floor, drain the pool, and cause the worst imaginable accident, which Brookhaven has estimated at tens of thousands of people will die from cancers as a result of a fuel pool fire. So you don't want to go there. It's kind of obvious. So the second way would be to use those smaller cranes they have on site and develop a special canister that maybe would only move two or three pieces of fuel at a time. But you got to get it off of that high floor and onto the ground. And the faster, the better. So that's sort of my proposed alternative. They already have another fuel storage spot on the site. So if you could get the fuel off that pool onto the ground and then into that other spent fuel storage pool, the problem is 95% mitigated. And the third alternative is to build a building around the building and then put a heavy-duty crane on that building and use that. The problem there is that, you know, like you said, the chance of a severe earthquake are significant over the next year or two. If you want to gamble that it won't happen, the best thing to do would be to build a building around the building and put a crane in there. But given the consequences, I think the middle alternative, specially design a really small cask that can take out two or three bundles at a time and get them on the ground and then put them into the existing pool.
Oh, I know the one you mean. It's got about 6,000 fuel rods in it right now.
And time is of the essence. We really don't want to wait 5 or 10 years to pull this off. And Unit 3, you know, you started the lead in on this whole piece by talking about Unit 3. Unit 3 is worse. It's mechanically, it's rubble, the pool of rubble. And it's got less fuel in it. But it faces the same problems. You know, structurally, the pool has been dramatically weakened. And God, nobody's even gotten near it yet. So we've got to get the fuel out of Unit 4 because that's where most of it is. And then you got to move on to Unit 3 and pull the fuel from that pool just as quickly as you can.
And you were an expert and, in fact, an executive in a company that dealt with fuel rod assemblies, were you not?
Yes, we. My division built nuclear fuel racks for boiling water reactors, just like Fukushima. We built the fuel racks for Vermont Yankee, for instance. So, yes, I understand the process. You know, the problem is that it's called the heavy lift. The fuel can't be picked up and lifted through air and put down on the back of a pickup and driven off. The fuel is so radioactive that if it becomes airborne, it's, you know, lethal doses within 100 feet and perhaps even more than that. And, of course, if all the fuel were to become unshielded, if all the water were to drain away, it's likely you'd have to evacuate a large portion of the site. So you really don't want that pool to become dry. After it becomes dry, it would also catch fire, and that's the worst case for the large population. But should it go dry, there's a period in between when it's so radioactive, it creates something called sky shine. The gamma rays from the fuel go up, bounce off air molecules, and come down. The fancy word is Compton scattering, but it would irradiate the entire site to the point where you just couldn't move people around. Yeah, not a place you want to be. So that heavy lift has to be done perfectly. When you put the fuel into these large canisters, you can't drop the canister.
Don't drop the canister. Oh, my. This is Radio EcoShock with former nuclear industry executive and expert witness Arnold Gunderson from Fairwinds.com. Arnie, before we get back to this ultimate threat, it seems to me, of nuclear fuel rods dangling in a very damaged building and two damaged buildings at Fukushima, Japan, I have to say the triple meltdown of the reactors operating at the time of the quake, that's not over either. What is the news about reactor number two, for example?
Well, number two has... They were able to get a probe into the containment, not into the reactor, but into the containment. They had thought there would be 30 feet of water. In fact, there was only 2 feet of water. And you're counting on the water as shielding. And the radiation exposures were 7,000 R an hour, which basically would kill you in 10 minutes. So it's a radiation exposure that would kill carbon-based life forms. And it's also so high that it'll wipe out robots pretty quickly, too. And that's the bad news, is that the numbers are so high, but that's the best unit. Unit 2 is the one that people can get closest to. Unit 1 and Unit 3 are even worse. So the question is, how are they ever going to get these cores cleaned up? Because it's coming from the radioactive cores. You know, we're at a point where we have to count on brand-new science. There's nothing on the market and nothing foreseeable that's going to be able to go into these containments and knock those exposures down. The alternative is to wait 300 years because most of it is coming from cesium, And 300 years out, those numbers will drop down. But if the alternative is waiting 300 years, somehow I don't think that's very politically palatable.
Wow. So we need to invent a technology that hasn't been invented yet. So, Arnie, I think it's time to think the unthinkable. Walk us through what could happen if we wake up one day and the news is just this, that Fukushima Daiichi Reactor 4, the fuel pool, and the building have collapsed.
There's a Brookhaven National Lab study that actually talks about this. The building doesn't have to collapse, or the bottom of the fuel pool just has to break. Now, fortunately, back right after the accident, one of the very first things the Tokyo Electric did, was put an enormous number of brand new structural supports under the bottom of the pool. But the building is unstable because it's been damaged by its own explosion, and separately, though, it's been damaged by the explosion right next door to Unit 3. So in a severe earthquake, 7 or better, it's likely to break. Now, whether break means, you know, collapse and lay on its side like the Leaning Tower of Pisa, or the pool itself just shatters, I don't know. But in either case, the outcome is this. The water drains and the fuel gets hot, physically hot. Two things happen. The water was providing shielding as well as cooling, and the exposures on site become astronomical. We looked at this back in the States when Dresden 1 almost had a fuel pool drain all its water. They forgot to turn the heat on when the unit was shut down and the pipes froze, and it almost caused the entire fuel pool to drain because of these frozen pipes. They estimated that if the Dresden pool had drained, no one could have gotten within 300 or 400 feet of the thing. And, of course, this pool is much bigger with much more radiation. So the first issue is that you'd have to evacuate a significant part of the site just because the gamma rays coming out of the pool were so great that you couldn't get near it. The second thing happens in perhaps a day or two where the fuel gets hot enough to ignite in air. Zirconium, which is what the fuel is clad with, at 2,200 degrees Fahrenheit, wants to absorb oxygen. And if the oxygen is in water, it will suck up the oxygen in water and create hydrogen, which happened in the explosions on 1, 2, and 3. But if the fuel is just exposed to air, it's going to take the oxygen out of air and burn. You know, when it's going to create zirconium oxide, and that's basically a fire. So if the fuel catches fire, you volatilize the cesium, you volatilize the strontium, you volatilize the plutonium, and, a witch's brew of other isotopes, which then go airborne as a micron-sized hot particle, and they get breathed in. My advice to our friends in Tokyo is every morning check the tube and make sure that Unit 4 is still standing. And the moment you hear Unit 4 is not still standing, leave. And that's been my advice for a year. So then the health consequences, the Brookhaven study says tens of thousands of fatalities from cancers because of the hot particles that are thrown up from the fire.
Now, from the selfish point of view of someone living on the west coast of North America, and I guess for everyone in the Northern Hemisphere, it seems to me the key point is whether there is a major explosion that could drive these radioactive materials into the stratosphere where they will spin around the world. And how do you estimate the risk of a major explosion if that Reactor 4 building collapses, for example?
Yeah, I don't think it's going to be an explosion. I think it's going to be a fire. But I still would be concerned if I lived on the West Coast. The heat of this fire is extraordinary, so that the particles are buoyant. You know, they're going to be extraordinarily hot, 3,000 degrees. So you're going to have an upward moving thermal plume that's going to push this thing up 5, 6, 7 miles, and then it'll be pushed by the jet stream. The hot particles we've already seen on the West Coast probably didn't come from a single event, but were lifted by the smoky fires that we experienced back in March of last year. This fire would be hotter, so it would essentially be this pyre of ionized gases that would lift the hot particles up high enough to get in the jet stream and hit the West Coast. So, you know, there's a lot of air between the West Coast of the United States and the East Coast of Japan, so certainly the Japanese would have to worry more. But, it would be appropriate to have monitoring planes looking for the plume and letting people know where the plume was if this event happens. You know, I think we all just have to pray that this earthquake doesn't happen until the fuel is out. I think it's pretty clear it will happen, but it doesn't happen until the fuel is out. Or if it does, it's a small enough earthquake that the building doesn't crack.
Yeah, I think we have to make this clear to listeners that this isn't a guaranteed event, that we don't have to totally panic right now, because there is a possibility that we may luck our way through this and not have yet another major, major nuclear event from Fukushima. But there is the possibility it could happen. And so from my point of view, Arnie, we've just got to get the Japanese or some international body to do as much as we can to make it as safe as we can.
Yes, you're absolutely right. As quick as we can. We're in a world where people don't like to be, which is these low probability, high consequence events. Because of the damage to this unit and because of the increased seismicity in Japan over the last 3 or 4 years, it's no longer low probability, like 1 in a million. You know, if it's 1 in 100, that's awful. Because the consequences are so severe that even a 1 in 100 event would be mathematically devastating.
Yeah, we couldn't recover from it in anything in a meaningful human timescale. As you know, Dr. Robert Alvarez, an expert with the Union of Concerned Scientists, has tried again and again to warn us about this, that it isn't just a problem in Japan. And you've said this too. The American reactors have built up even more stored fuel rods, some of them over earthquake fault lines like in California, all of them requiring nonstop cooling. None of the storage pools that I know of have containment if there is an accident. Can you talk to us about the risk in America?
Well, the Mark I pools, and there's 23 in America, don't have a containment above them, and also the Mark IIs, and there's 4 or 5 of those, I can't remember. The General Electric Mark IIIs, and there's only a few of those, but also the pressurized water reactor pools are much better protected. So the real problem is these 23 Mark I's in the United States, and, you know, there's 2 in on Taiwan, and there's... So in America, we have left all of our fuel in these spent fuel pools. I was speaking at the Boston Library last summer with Dr. Gordon Thompson, and he calculated that there's more cesium in the Pilgrim Pool, and this pool is, you know, 40 miles from downtown Boston, than in the 800 bombs that were blown up in the atmospheric testing during the 50s, 60s, and 70s. And so if that pool were to catch fire, you know, the consequences go beyond what the Brookhaven lab numbers were. The key question is, why are we leaving it there? And the answer, unfortunately, is money. The owners of the plants, the technology is there. You reconstitute the fuel, put it in a cask, and put it down on the ground, and it's called, and it doesn't have to be water cooled, it can be air cooled. Each of those casks costs $2 million, and you need perhaps 30 of them. So we're looking at $100 million exposure, financial exposure, to the utility that owns the plant. But the consequence is the public exposure is dramatically less. The Nuclear Regulatory Commission has consistently bowed to the utility desires to keep the fuel there, to save $100 million a reactor. And it's a risk that we shouldn't be taking even before Fukushima. Now, Dr. Alvarez has been saying this now since, I don't know, 1994. So he's been a voice in the wilderness on this for, you know, close to 2 decades. And it all boils down to money. There's absolutely not a single technical reason why we can't get the fuel out of those pools and into dry storage underground.
Is there anything that you'd like to add for our listeners as we wrap up?
You know, I guess 2 things. One is that this debt of gratitude that I constantly feel toward the perhaps 2,000 men and a few women that basically saved the world back in March of last year. I'm not talking about the TEPCO executives because they totally botched this, but the men and women at those sites during the first week or two, risk their lives and certainly have increased their probability of cancer selflessly. And I think we all owe them a debt of gratitude. The second thing is that we're dealing with a technology that can destroy a country. Nikolai Gorbachev said in his memoirs that Chernobyl destroyed the Soviet Union, not perestroika. And, of course, we're watching Japan teeter right now. Should that fuel pool catch fire, it will cut Japan in half, you know, from east to west. And you can't have a functioning state when you've got a ribbon of radioactivity that's, you know, 50 miles wide running across the entire country. We really need to think about, is this a technology that that we should be doubling down on? Or is this a technology we should be developing a strategy to walk away from over time so that we can you know, move on to something that's a lot less risky?
We have been talking with one of the few nuclear industry experts who will talk. Arne Gunderson and his wife Maggie are the team at Fairwinds.com. In addition to informing the public, they offer expert testimony in nuclear court cases and government hearings. Be sure and support them at their website, fairwinds.com. Arne, thank you again for this update.
Thank you for having me, and thank you for caring enough to do the update.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
Before we investigate the tar sands with scientist David Schindler, check out this quick rant from the podcast A Moment of Clarity by New York comedian Lee Camp at leecamp.net. Thanks, Lee.
Well, here it is, ladies and gentlemen, the big one. Global warming. It's here. We all knew this was coming. This wasn't like when Ellen DeGeneres told everyone she was vacuuming the carpet and we all went, global warming? Lots of twists. No! 30 years ago, the scientists said, holy crap, we're gonna burn! And we went, oh my gosh, that's terrible. Let's build another cow manure factory. We could have aerosol spraying contests. Whee! So here it is. We asked for it. Turn up the lights and warm up the dance floor, because we just walked into Club Greenhouse and we're going down in a blaze of stupid. What is global warming? Global warming means the planet is heating up. It means that this place is going to keep getting hotter and hotter every year until the only things that can survive here are lizards and Michael Jackson's nose. You see that cute little bunny hopping around your backyard on fire? That's global warming, and we caused it. This is our fault, because we're putting more crap in the air than Carlos Mencia has coming out of his ears. We did this. So now you say, well, if we did this, then we can fix it, right? Well, we could, but the problem is there's a whole lot of people out there that don't even believe it's happening. They've put this in the land of mythical things that don't exist, right next to unicorns, the city of Atlantis, and Kevin Costner movies that don't suck. No, no, you see, this is just all a left-wing trick to try and damage the economy. Oh yeah, that's gotta be it. We want your money. You've uncovered our sinister plan. We want to clean up this planet so you'll be poor and have to buy your sex from a toothless chick named Roger at a Motel 6 in Utah and get chlamydia. We're calling it Project Burning Crotch. Hey, I want you to think about something for a second here, okay? What good is your money gonna do you if there's no air? What are you gonna do then? What do you know? I think I'd go and buy a new mansion. Oh, wait, I forgot. I can't because there's no air and I'm dead. It's like having a lifetime supply of Viagra on a desert island with nothing but a coconut tree and Tammy Faye Baker. You're not gonna use it. And sure, you know, we've got these little oxygen generators all over the planet. They're called trees. They make air. Unfortunately, they also make houses, tables, chairs, boats, fences, pencils, guitars, stairs, hamster cage bedding, Trojan horses, and the baseball bat I'm gonna start using to beat these idiots so bad they'll think they owed me drug money. So we're destroying all the trees, but we got this 3,000-year-old book that says that Earth ain't supposed to end that way, and we believe everything it says because it's made out of glowing holy goodness, and no, wait, it's made out of trees! What is wrong with you? Just how is the weather up your butt there? Okay, you know what? You don't have to believe in global warming. Say it's all a big load of crap, okay? The only thing we'd be left with is cleaner air, more fuel-efficient vehicles, and water that doesn't mutate your children. Is there anything wrong with that? The Earth is the only place we have to live, and if there's even a chance it could be in danger, don't you think that's something we should all be concerned about no matter what you believe? Because in the end, it's not about who's right and who's wrong. It's about making sure we're all still here to disagree.
Radio EcoShock.
I'm Alex Smith, and I'm angry. There are lots of sick and ugly things in this world, along with tremendous beauty and love. But there are two giant projects which I know offend God if there is one. The first is blowing the tops off mountains and plowing the rubble into nature's valleys. The second is the largest and most polluting industrial project on this earth, the Canadian tar sands. The big oil companies are spending millions, even hundreds of millions of dollars, to convince you they produce what they call ethical oil. They can afford it. They make a couple of billion in a quarter, just one company. It's everywhere. News columnists blather on about the wonderful oil sands and why we can't live without them, never mind the full-page ads from tar sands companies in that very same newspaper. I can't even go to a movie without seeing Hollywood-quality ads with butterflies and forests all around the new, clean, green tar sands operations. Here is the other side of the story, a quick clip from a talk by Mike Mercurdy, an Aboriginal man from Fort Chippewa, downstream from the tar sands.
My name is Mike Mercurdy. I'm a member of the community of Fort Chip. And Fort Chip is what we're calling the ground zero. It's a sacrifice zone. A sacrifice zone for this oil to be produced. And from it, extracts poison. Poison into the water, into the air, the land, the trees. Now the people are dying. I buried my auntie just this year. I buried my uncle a couple of years back. I got an auntie right now living with cancer. There's no known cancers in our family. Cancer doesn't exist in our family. Just in the last 15 years, all of a sudden cancer's popping up. But this is just not just my family. Although this is directly affected to me, which brings me here. And it's unfortunate that I have to be here. And I shouldn't be here. I shouldn't be here coming here to tell you that my people are dying. I shouldn't be here coming to tell you that I'm facing genocide. That your own countrymen are dying from this resource. This dark resource. This tar sands. This oil sands. It's a dark resource.
I recorded that in 2008 when we had no experts to back him up. Listen to the whole Radio EcoShock program, Climate Terrorism, the Tar Sands. Three speakers recorded December 5th in Vancouver. It's listed on our 2008 show archive page at ecoshock.org. But as you will hear in this program, they are lying about being able to reclaim land to their former natural state. The oil companies and the governments who collude with them are faking and hiding the health effects. The whole tar sands operation is a world-scale Ponzi scheme which will bankrupt future generations with the costs of cleanup, if any remediation is possible. Or they will do what most mining companies do, leave a massive open scar upon the earth, all for the quick quarterly profits of foreign multinationals. Who says so? According to the Canadian Prime Minister, Stephen Harper, and his Environment Minister, anyone who criticizes the tar sands is just a foreign-funded radical, unpatriotic environmentalists and such. Let's meet one of those radicals. Here is the introduction to Dr. David Schindler before his speech in Vancouver on March 28, 2012.
I want to welcome you to this series of lectures on Planet Under Stress, organized by Dr. Patricia Gallagher and Laurie Wood from SFU's Center for Coastal Science and Management. We are particularly fortunate to have as our speaker this evening Dr. David Schindler, Killam Memorial Professor of Ecology at the University of Alberta. His distinguished research record in limnology, ecology, aquatic ecosystem science has been recognized, of course, nationally and internationally by an absolutely astounding number of honors and awards, such as at a minimum 10 honorary degrees, a Fellow of the Royal Society, Officer of the Order of Canada, just to name a few, as a Sanford Fleming Medal Award winner, and I quote, to a scientist who is able to bridge the gap between the lab and the people. This last accolade, I believe, is especially important one if you are properly to understand the cumulative impact and significance of his research for Canadian society. In many ways, Dr. Schindler is what I would refer to as a scientific sleuth with a wonderful ability to identify smoking guns when it comes to identifying complex cause and effect relationships in aquatic ecosystems. Arguably, he has made and continues to make important contributions to what I would call action science, where the best of evidence-based scientific research is used to promote environmental amelioration and mitigation strategies through public action. Among his most noteworthy accomplishments is the leadership role he played in 1968 as a Canadian federal research scientist in what was termed at the time in the large-scale Whole Lakes experiments. He and his colleagues clearly identified the role of phosphorus in freshwater lake eutrophication, Policy change soon followed in banning the release of high phosphate detergents and the use of phosphorus in sewage treatment plants in the Great Lakes Basin. Other examples of this penchant for action science include identifying the clear link between cold fire plants and acid rain, for which he received the Order of Canada in 2004. More recently, he has been a firm critic of the destruction of the Canadian boreal forest, arguing, and I would certainly agree with this, that the value of carbon storage in the boreal forest is worth many times more than what we get back from boreal industries. And within the context of the growing scarcity of water in the prairies, he has warned about the environmental impact of a rapidly expanding agricultural sector as climate change alters the basic parameters for sustainability. And his work on the contamination of surface waters, notably in the Athabasca water from the oil sands development, and its impact on fish habitat and health have forced action on the need for better monitoring.
That is the wild-eyed radical the Prime Minister fears, a lifelong scientist who helped clean up the Great Lakes from phosphorus, who proved the source of acid rain, a world-recognized and heavily awarded expert, David Schindler. David is no fly-in academic from New York. He lives in northern Alberta. He's fished in the many streams threatened by the proposed Enbridge Northern Pipeline. He measures the water and the air, finding pollution governments denied. I'm going to summarize some of the surprising revelations in this speech, bolstered by selected audio. For example, did you know the tiny amounts of supposedly reclaimed lands by the companies can never be returned to their previous state because the mine tailings are just too salty? I also didn't realize the biggest source of pollution is actually airborne. We'll learn about all that and more in this workshop from Canada's top tar sands expert, a quiet but devastating critic of the world's dirtiest source of oil. The government won't investigate the many deaths on the reserves. The former Alberta caribou herds will never return. The forests are being stripped in an area projected to be larger than the state of Florida when it's all said and done. Countless tons of methane are burned and released just to get the oil out of the sands, more greenhouse gases. The corrosive raw oil is carried in a network of pipelines, tankers, trucks, and famous spills. It's an industrial spider web reaching down into the United States, indeed all over North America. Wherever you live in the world, the tar sands are wrecking your atmosphere as the single largest industrial source of greenhouse gases on the planet. The damage can be seen from space and will last for thousands of years. Welcome to your secure energy source, your damned ethical oil. David Schindler begins with the tailing ponds, some of which are just meters away from the Athabasca River. According to Tar Sands Watch, every square meter of oil-bearing bitumen mined creates 6 square meters of tailings. These are tossed into toxic lakes, now covering more than 55 square kilometers, over 13,000 acres and growing rapidly. The tailing dike of just one company, Syncrude, is the world's second largest dam. Only the Chinese Three Gorges Dam is larger. Here is David Schindler.
They're not ponds anymore. It's like more like a toxic Great Lake. And the technology of how to process tailings from bitumen without creating those seems to be eluding the companies. This is the Athabasca River. As you can see from the small panel on the left side, it crosses Alberta diagonally, starting in the headwaters in the Rockies, and then it turns north right at Fort McMurray, which used to be a sleepy little trapping town when I started working there in the 1970s, flows straight north to the Peace Athabasca Delta, where it flows into Lake Athabasca along with the Peace River, and it's such a lush delta that there are about 3,000 native people there, and they've lived there for thousands of years. The size of the area of Alberta that can be exploited for oil sands is huge. Doesn't look much like much on an Alberta map. Now I'll be talking mostly about this small pink area, which is the area that they can surface mine. But the new greenwash is, oh, we're not going to do that kind of damage to the rest out in this red area. But the oil sands are roughly the size of the country of Greece, and given the state of Greece in the EU right now, maybe we could make them a trade. I think it would be a pretty good trade.
David then makes several key points.
Well, the last few years, there's been rather shameless promotion of the oil sands. Alberta Environment's budget for ecology on the Athabasca River was $300,000 last year, but their propaganda budget for promotions was $25 million. So it gives you an idea of what's going on, and the sorts of things that are being said are illustrated on this slide, one of our former premier's talks, and it sounds like the current premier is going to continue with this sort of promotion. The result of that has been an exponential increase in development. We're here right now, and all of these arrows over on the right side are other developments that have already been approved. So Fort McMurray has grown from 7,000 to where now it's about 77,000. And in addition, there are about 50,000 people in work camps by their best estimates. They'd estimated there was 30,000, and when they actually did a census, they found about 45, and they weren't sure they got them all. So the true number in those camps is probably around 50,000 people. Well, 7.5% a year is what that works out to as an exponential. That's a doubling time of every 10 years if you use a compound formula. That's twice the rate of development of any sane development. Infrastructure just can't keep up, which is why there are buildings falling down and roads can't handle the traffic and hospitals can't accommodate the people. So it's a pretty strange sort of development going on. And the spin is that Canadians make a lot of money from the oil sands. But this is a report that was released last week, figures through 2010, by the Parkland Institute at the University of Alberta. And you can see here the overall profits in the oil sands the last few years have been in the $30 to $40 billion a year range. The blue and the green down here are what Canadians get out of that. So it's the order of less than 10% of the overall profits. All of this red area is going to companies. So it doesn't make a lot of sense. The reason for that, and this is also from the same report, is that over the lifetime of the tar sands, the royalties, the proportion that Albertans get has gone down, down, down. In Peter Lougheed's day, we were getting around 30 and as high as 40% at that peak. They were reduced under Don Getty, a bit more under Ralph Klein, and they took a big dive under Ed Stelmach. So you wonder what's next. So right now we're getting about 12% of the profits being made there. So you see strange equations like we hear talk about all these riches, but we're told the Alberta budget is $6 billion in the red, and yet every time you pick up a paper, there's another company reporting a quarterly profit on the order of $2 billion. Something is wrong with this picture. This is the Parkland Institute's take on it, no wonder all these companies want to get in on the oil sands. It's a really good deal. They're tripping all over themselves to get in on the action. And we're told that cumulative effects assessment is being done, but I can't see it. You could fly a plane load of village idiots handpicked for low IQ around the world over this area and ask them, do you see any cumulative impact? I think they'd all say yes. So by continuing to tell us this, they must think we've all just fallen off a turnip truck.
From the recording March 28th in Vancouver, here is what David Schindler says about ethical oil.
We also hear a lot about this ethical oil, how we have to buy Canadian oil rather than this nasty oil from countries where they mistreat their women. Somehow I don't think it's any worse to mistreat a woman than it is to mistreat both sexes of all the Aboriginal people. And exporting 70% of the take to the U.S. when our own eastern coast has to rely on those same unethical sources of oil. Meanwhile, if you're under 40, you're going to pay for this development, as I'll show you later. The scheme is clearly that the profit will be made by my generation. We're going to scram out of here and be pushing up daisies when time comes to pay the bill. I'll show you some figures that illustrate that clearly later on. And is it ethical to rely on propaganda to sell the oil sands to Canadians and to people offshore rather than putting it into some environmental science? This is one of the people now who's branded any green groups and by insinuation anybody who would dare say anything against the oil sands is radical extremists. So I guess I'm a radical extremist. And we have a whole cabinet full of these folks right now. I don't think these green groups deserve a lot of credit for what's happening in the oil sands. The voices that I listen to are Peter Lougheed, the guy who started the oil sands, who about 3-4 times a year is quoted as saying the oil sands development should slow down. Or people like our former environment minister, Jim Prentice, who says that the Keystone Pipeline shows a need to improve its record after several oil spills were revealed. Those are the folks that I think people listen to, not Greenpeace, or they listen to companies. And companies are not doing themselves any favor. Can you imagine Greenpeace, with all its foreign funding, getting the kind of press that having 1,600 oil ducks on the front page of every newspaper around the globe for a year did, along with some absurd proclamation by some high-powered lawyer that it was the duck's fault? This is what Syncrude chose to do to itself, rather than quietly paying a fine and getting out of the press. So we don't need green groups with the kind of antics we see from our politicians and companies in the oil sands. They're doing a fine job of giving themselves a black eye.
Okay, now we're going for a long walk through David Schindler's presentation. He talks about cancer in the native people, how the industry-sponsored river testing found nothing, no contaminants, from the super-polluting smokestacks or the tailing ponds. His own team of scientists found a wide range of heavy metals and toxic polycarbonates the industry and government somehow failed to detect.
Well, the focus of a lot of attention has been the alleged increased cancer rates in Fort Chipewyan. I started hearing about those in the 1990s. I've worked up there off and on since the 70s, and was rumored that more and more people were dying of cancer. By the 1990s, the evidence was strong enough that the Northern River Basin study, which had a number of eminent scientists and a number of eminent citizens on it, recommended that it was time to do a detailed health study. But nobody did. The government just deep-sixed the report. And then early in this decade, the local physician up there sounded the alarm that he thought there were a high number. And he was, of course, stripped of his practice and heavily discounted and moved to Newfoundland for a period. Luckily, he was exonerated in the end and he was back. But the first detailed study that was done was by the Alberta Cancer Board in just 3 years ago, and they did indeed find a higher rate of cancers. Not a lot higher. It's possible that the number is due to chance. But again, they recommended a health study because it was close enough, it was high enough on the end of probability that there was reason for some concern. But the government's position in Alberta has been, well, it can't be caused by the oil sands because nothing from the oil sands gets into the river. We have it all totally blocked. And if you were to believe them, all of the pollutants in the river would be coming from little seeps like this. And there are lots of these in the banks of the Athabasca and its tributaries. They were places that Aboriginal people used to stop and tar their leaky birch bark canoes. But that would also mean that there was nothing coming out of the atmosphere. Yet there are two big upgraders up there that burn coke and smelt bitumen, which has a periodic table full of contaminants, many of them toxic. And the reason I thought that was of concern is that 30 years ago, I chaired a panel for the U.S. National Academy, which looked at this problem worldwide, and we did not find a single source of fossil fuel burning or smelting that did not discharge a host of contaminants to the atmosphere, toxic trace metals and organic compounds, and they fall back into the biosphere at various distances from the source, depending on their properties. So, and some other things, nothing's getting into the river, but the same companies saying that are reporting to the National Pollutant Research or a Release Inventory that their output from those same stacks has tripled in 8 years. All you have to do to check up on this company now, thanks to EcoJustice and a few environmental groups, is Google on the letters NPRI, and you'll get this huge spreadsheet of the periodic table versus your favorite companies, and you can see over time how much they've been putting out. So somehow the companies were reporting they were putting this out, but it's mysteriously disappearing. And also, if you believe that it's all those little seeps, that means that developments like this is the Athabasca River at the bottom, are yielding nothing to the river. And for somebody who's worked on watersheds for 40 years, Watershed Science 101 is that you strip the soils and vegetation, expose the underlying fresh geology, put rain and snow on it, and the runoff magically increases in any elements that are in that fresh geologic substrate. That had to be what was happening. This little orange barrier is like the things that you see in road ditches when they're scooping out the ditches. And this is the Athabasca. There's a lot more of this going on in the tributaries that are mined. In some cases, they're scooping the tributaries right out. Another warning sign, this regional aquatic monitoring program that's industry-sponsored has been doing the monitoring since 1997. This doesn't show up too well. I chose the wrong color, but this quote is, I think, pretty telling. This was a 2004 review. There's no overall regional plan. There are clear questions that weren't being addressed, significant shortfalls with respect to statistical design, on and on and on. That was a warning sign for me a few years ago, yet that report was never made public until Andrew Nikiforuk found it, put it on the web, and made it visible via his book. But RAMP was reviewed a second time during this past year when we had half the scientists in Canada, it seemed, doing panels. This is the URL if you want to look at it. They found that RAMP had fulfilled one of its seven objectives. They had found in this 2004 review that it had fulfilled none of its seven objectives. But the one it had fulfilled was to get itself re-reviewed. So other than that, it was the same report, just as scathing as the 2004 report. Another warning sign is this group of stars represents the provincial monitoring plan. when they found that RAMP was not doing such a great job on organic pollutants, they decided to monitor them. This is their $300,000 program. The five-sided stars are on the Athabasca, and the four-sided ones are on tributaries. How you can separate the effects of industry and natural sources by having one site at the mouth of a tributary is beyond me. I haven't figured that one out in 50 years of doing science. So to me, that was another warning sign. So with all of the things I just showed you, I had lunch with the minister in 2007, and he just waved all those arguments away. And we have 4 million data points on the river. It's the most comprehensive monitoring program anywhere in the world. Everything's under control. So three of us decided we'd do our own study. Jeff Short, who's a scientist with the U.S. National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, and Peter Hodson, who's a toxicologist at Queen's, and I met because we were hired by the Alberta government as experts to help design the program for Lake Wabamun after Canadian National Railway spilled 7 cars of Bunker C into the lake. And in comparing the contaminants and the effects, our conversation turned to the Exxon Valdez, which Jeff had been studying for 20 years, and the oil sands, where Peter had done a lot of toxicology and produced several PhD students. So we got some money from the Walter and Duncan Gordon Foundation and the Tides Foundation, and hired Erin Kelly, who'd done her PhD with me a few years before on mercury, to do our own field study. And we chose to do several sites on the tributaries and more on the Athabasca.
This is Radio EcoShock. That was Dr. David Schindler, an internationally renowned scientist. He's talking about his team research into the pollution from the tar sands. I hope you got one of the stories Schindler explained, as I understand it. Dr. Schindler and other scientists could not accept the industry-funded, government-approved studies saying that none of the dirty pollutants from the tar sands operations could be measured in the Athabasca River or its tributaries. They found that alleged testing set up measuring stations either upstream of the operations or far down the river near the mouth at Lake Athabasca, where dilution would be greatest. The testing method that was used had a baseline or used techniques which eliminated low levels of contaminants. Contaminants that we now know can lead to cancer. Three scientists, David Schindler, Jeff Short of NOAA, and Peter Hodson, a toxicologist at Queen's University, took their own samples. These included sites near the tar sands operations for once. This independent team used better testing methods. They found low levels of many, many toxic substances, especially near the so-called upgrader plants, where air pollution is strong and obvious. This is a scandal. The First Nations people living downstream from the tar sands complained for years their families were dying of cancer. Industry and the government told the victims there was no pollution in the water. As I said earlier, Radio EcoShock on December 5, 2008 ran 3 speeches on the impacts of the tar sands. One of the speakers was Mike Mercurdy, who told us of his many friends, relatives, and close family members who died of cancer. You aren't going to hear the dirty truth about the tar sands from any authority, and certainly not from the millions spent on propaganda by the multinational oil companies digging out the tar. This is Radio EcoShock at ecoshock.org. We are out of time for this week, but not out of ammunition. In an upcoming Radio EcoShock show, you'll hear more from famous scientist David Schindler. He'll tell us why the heavily advertised restoration of the scoured landscape is fake. Remaking nature is not possible, and it's not going to happen. The native people like Mike Mercurdy knew that all along. They live there, they eat the polluted fish, they're breathing the polluted air.
They're sugarcoating it into something that we think it's not. But to tell you, it's BS. Everything they say about it being, it's the reclaiming the land, no, they're not. The water is okay, no, it ain't. Is the air all right? I don't think so. Because if these things that we're consuming and living with is killing us, and you're telling us that it's okay, you might as well come give me, put a gun to my head. A quick death would be a hell of a lot more easier than a slow, hard, painful death and a thing like cancer. So think about these things. Thank you.
Keep your ears out for more on the Canadian tar sands, the world's single largest source of pollution, on Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. Thank you for getting real about your world.